Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Tim Armstrong. And Tim is here to talk with us about everyone's favorite topic these days, AI or artificial intelligence, and how it applies to the practice of law. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you very much, Todd. We're glad to join you guys today.
Well, why don't we start with you telling our audience a little bit about yourself, who you are, your background, and I guess what leads you to be interested in AI and qualified to talk about it and educate us on it.
Sure. I joined the legal industry about 30 years ago, you know, being educated, an IT background as well as a financial background, undergrad in accounting, and an MBA ultimately in finance. I joined Vinson & Elkins in actually their Dallas office at the time in more of a financial management role and kind of migrated from the finance side into IT, incredible amount of IT work, ultimately took the role as chief information officer. Got a call to go back to the finance side, moved into the CFO role at V&E, and then ultimately in 2009, moved over to the chief operating role. In that, I've stayed very close to technology over the years. And AI is just one of those new creative things. It kind of takes me back 20 years ago to when we started talking about knowledge management and how we organized a lot around it. And I do think AI will have a lot of potential there to help us automate and do what we started to try to do 20 years ago.
Yeah, I guess about that time, you know, you bring up knowledge management. That was a time in which law firms were really undergoing a pretty serious transformation and how they kept track of what they had already done and tried to leverage that going forward. And that does seem to be a point where there's a natural fit with AI.
Yeah, I think that's true. One of the debates that we used to have a lot on the KM side, we had a number of lawyers. We had a technology oversight committee and developed a knowledge management committee at the time. And there was this desire to do this white bar, really universal search that we would point at all of our data. One of the things people never really would appreciate or wanted to acknowledge was that all of the data wasn't that good. And so there was still a need to go through and clean it up and organize it so that people were doing these white bar searches, which this was in the days after Google. People was very used to searching, you know, what they classified as white bar searches, just going to, you know, a line and typing. But a lot of times in those returns of information, you got a lot of information that you didn't necessarily want or wasn't relevant. And we were working on ways to try to rank and add quality to that data. And it was hard. It was very difficult. I mean, it's like being these kind of technologies we've done all the years, no dig at lawyers, but they're real interested until we turn the tables back and say, hey, we actually need you to help us build it and train it or do whatever. And then they lose interest in a hurry.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
No, you're not wrong. Well, before we launch into some of the details, you played all those different roles at V&E, and I can't say that I have come across anybody who has worn quite so many hats in a very, very large law firm. And the fact that you not only were COO, but you were the chief information officer and the chief financial officer at various points in time, I mean, you've got some marketable skills there, Tim.
Yeah, it's kept me busy, for sure.
I bet.
Tim, are you still at V&E?
I'm not. I left V&E in the summer of 2022. We had a large management turnover kind of coming out of 2021. And it was a decision point for me on what I wanted to do. And after a little over 29 years, I decided it was time for me to branch out and do something else. So I've been doing work for the past year with a number of other firms just on a consulting basis, doing actually some advisory work on the M&A projects that are going out there now, which is a nice, interesting turn. I mean, I get to work with some acquirer firms that are looking at acquirees. And I get pulled in to do a lot of analysis and review of those firms from an operating and in financial capacity, which just allows me to take advantage of the skill sets that I've developed over the years.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry.
And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Well, let's talk about, just to kind of set the stage here, what generative AI is. You could hardly be breathing and listening to this podcast and not have heard the term, especially if you're in the legal industry these days, but it's just so pervasive and all the things that we read in the industry news and articles and so forth. But I think it would be beneficial to kind of understand where generative AI fits into overall technology issues and just generally what it is. So can you give us a quick explanation of it?
Sure. Generative AI, I mean, it really gained a lot of traction, obviously, coming out of 2022 when OpenAI released their ChatGPT model, which GPT is just a generative pre-trained transformer. There has been a number of iterations of artificial intelligence over the years, from artificial intelligence into machine learning. I will admit, I'll digress a little bit, had a great interest in machine learning over the years and looking at what we do. I mean, focus on the financial side of the firm, the operational side of the firm. Firms are producing an incredible number of data points, metrics over the years that has gotten to the point that it's very hard to consume. In fact, we produce so much information, it's very hard to organize and project to the leadership. And so I started talking to a number of my folks about developing these intelligent triggers and a lot of our KPIs and all, to where I didn't have to come in and consume an overwhelming number of data points. I could get kind of information presented and filtered to me in a way so that I would know a little bit about what to look at through these so-called intelligent triggers. Generative AI is kind of a step beyond that. It goes into deep learning. I mean, it's been 10 years or so back that probably a lot of deep learning started, really in the 2015, 2016 timeframe. We started hearing more and more about it with the Googles and all doing a lot of work on the AI side. OpenAI obviously out there doing some stuff as well. And it was really the concept of deep learning. And that's really where I got interested in a little bit, because I wanted to understand, started hearing the term deep learning. I wanted to understand what they were doing and how they were training these models and what they were ultimately using to produce the information that they were. And that's when I started learning more about generative AI, but really started learning about the building of the neural networks and things like that they were using to train the data, which I will say, I mean, some of the people that build these complex neural networks, as I've read lately, still don't completely understand how they work at times. They learn and all the information that they produce turns into math, and you use the math to develop the generative AI piece. You know, once these large language models are built, the chat piece of it is what is built to actually engage with the model.
Can I have you pause for a sec? Because I just want to clarify a little bit of terminology, because I'm not an AI guy. And so I just want to, if you don't mind, take a few minutes just to kind of step us through what some of these terms are. One of the ones you mentioned was deep learning. If you can kind of explain that, and maybe neural networks. I know those are dense topics, but just sort of a high level view for those of us that are appellate lawyers.
If you think about these things, really, AI is the overarching piece, and then machine language is a part of that. And then deep learning is another piece of it. And deep learning is really what you see associated with a lot of people that are talking about the large language models and how those are built. Large language models and all of that take an enormous number of compute cycles to build. What I have said a lot, and what Todd would have heard me say during my presentation, is a lot of law firms are not really doing the learning side. That's where the Harveys and others are coming into play. If you've heard about what Harvey is doing on the legal side, where they're really using what I would consider the distributed framework out there coming from the Microsoft and others to provide the compute cycles to actually build these large language models that can be used for the chat exercises that are going on now, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, I think what I've heard you say before, Tim, and you alluded to me having heard you speak before at a conference here in Austin, and that's where I came across you. But you've kind of diagrammed out AI and machine learning and deep learning into sort of a Venn diagram sort of illustration, with AI being sort of the big circle, which is essentially just, it is a technique which allows machines to mimic human behavior. And then machine learning is a subset of that. And then deep learning is a subset of that, where it starts to mimic human behavior at some point, or at least it fools us enough to be fooled if we're actually talking to a chatbot sometimes. For lay people like me and Jody, for sometimes it is rather difficult to get your mind around this. And so I appreciate you taking the time to kind of step back a little bit from it, because I think we can follow the conversation, but we want to make sure that our listeners have the terminology for their benefit too.
You're giving me more credit than I probably deserve, Todd, but I appreciate it.
So, all right. So picking up from there, I mean, let's go back to Gen AI and what it does, because I don't want to put my own words out there. I would like, Tim, we're going to talk about practicalities of it, and probably the ultimate question that everybody wants to know, at least everybody listening to this podcast, which is it going to take our jobs? So let's just take a step back and go through Gen AI further in terms of how we're seeing it, what it's capable of doing right now, and how we're seeing it in our everyday lives.
Sure. The generative AI piece, and I think that is what most folks are going to be interested in. That's definitely what most lawyers are going to be interested in. There's some of us on the backside that will be interested in other variations of the AI that is out there and how we use. But generative AI is what is really being brought forward and what people are talking about in tools that are being made available. And let me say, I think there are some tools out there that I'll jump into a little bit just because I think it is relevant to talking about the whole generative AI piece and the prompt level, which is what people will hear a lot about. I mean, generative AI, I mean, it is essentially, you've got these large language models, and really all the large language model is it's trained and it reads an incredible amount of data. In fact, I mean, it's where a lot of the initial lawsuits were kind of established, because, you know, OpenAI and some of the other LLMs, they were just going out and pulling information from the general internet or whatever and feeding all of these large language models all this information. And so the people started saying, well, wait a minute, that's got my data in it. It's got books maybe that I've written that have been compiled. And so that was the genesis of some of the lawsuits. And then ultimately the generative AI, I mean, it's very easy to go out to OpenAI and create an account. And there's a number of these out there now where then you're presented with this, you know, kind of blank prompt, and you can start asking it questions and doing things to it to get information out. And that prompt framework is really what is going to be key. I mean, there have been some firms like the Devil Voices have gone out and they've offered prompt engineering training to their summer associate class. Some of the tools that are like coming from NetDocuments are all tools that really automate kind of the prompt element, you know, and help craft the prompts that are going into Gen AI that will have to help extract information. And the prompts will do all kind of things. There are specific elements in there. There are tone elements in there. There are a lot of things that you can put and ask in there that will craft a very unique response back from whatever large language model you happen to be engaged in interface with. And that is really, I think, where a lot of the work is being done today, particularly on the legal side, whatever tools. And it is about getting the right prompt to ask the right question of generative AI so that it can then generate from the LLM information that is relevant to what you put against it. It's one of those things, if you add a bad or incomplete question, you know, you're liable to get not great information. So that is a big important deal, is getting people trained to use these tools correctly.
Which sounds a lot kind of the analog to electronic research and training people how to use Westlaw and Lexis and getting the right queries there.
It is exactly that. And I think what is going to complicate it more, you know, and this was a point that I made in the discussion that Todd referenced, is everyone has an AI tool. They're not even calling it Gen AI or whatever else, but, you know, whatever vendor you're talking to has some element of AI that's built in their solution. So one of the things that I told the group in speaking and the people that I talked to, you can't stand up today and say, well, here's the AI solution that your firm ought to engage. It's more, here's a string of AI solutions. It's coming in a lot of the tools that you already use. And oh, by the way, they're all going to be priced separately, and there's going to be a different cost element to it. So of the vendors, and, you know, I don't want to talk too negatively about the vendors, but they look at this, you know, I mean, this is ways for them to generate new revenue streams. And it's just one of the things that I talk to firms about understanding what your agreements are like, when they're up for renewal, how you evaluate the product offerings and, you know, these tools are what you bring in, because they will add expense to your whatever budget, and whether it's a practice budget or technology budget or whatever else, it will cost money.
For sure. So going back to the large language models for just a minute, is you mentioned ChatGPT, of course, that's the one everyone is most familiar with. There are others. How do these vendors, I guess I'll call them, determine what makes up the model that they're going to use? Do they create their own, or are they using some universal model?
It's a very good question. And this is something else, just to back up a little bit. I mean, what I caution the firms about is whatever you talk to your vendor about, you need to understand what they're using. What LLM are they pointing to? There are a number of different LLMs out there today, and they're changing all the time. In fact, there's a concept that you will hear discussed more called new frontier models, which are the new models that are coming out from the OpenAI. It's the Geminis from the Googles and other things. There are a number of these LLMs out there that are growing and changing. And then understanding what tool that they're using. I mean, they're, you know, we'll digress a little bit more and I apologize. You see these firms that are coming out and saying, oh, you know, we have our own ChatGPT. Well, when you really peel back the layers of it, they're really building it on something, you know, from Microsoft, on Microsoft Azure, which the tech folks will really appreciate. I mean, it is a foundational element out there. And Microsoft has a relationship with OpenAI. And part of their, what I would consider their intelligence genome, for lack of a better way to describe it, OpenAI is there. And when these firms are talking about, you know, that they're using the OpenAI model and they're using it closed, they're not exposing their data, they're really using it inside that Azure framework. And that is like anytime that I see any solution, I start trying to tear it down to understand what large language model are you using and what have you done to it? Have you done any kind of specific training with it? I've started seeing the concept now, particularly around contract lifecycle management, we were talking about the use of frozen models, which means that they're taking one of these large language models. That is what you're connecting to and using, but they're not allowing that model to change. It's not being updated. It's not learning from what you're asking it to do, which is, you know, addressing some of the privacy concerns and all that, that you don't have information spilling back into the model. But then the models are really updated from an engineering standpoint. It's very, very controlled and you know what's going on with it. But understanding what that large language model is, what the basis of it is, whether, you know, it is OpenAI models or it's one of the other large vendors that is building it, what's been done to that model. To me right now, there are so many issues with the models, potential issues. I mean, I've read about certification programs against the model that will guarantee the viability and the integrity of that model. Because it is something that is, I mean, at the end of the day, it is reading and converting a lot of what I call unstructured data out there and just turning it into math, it can be influenced. And that is part of the concern. I won't get into too much of that yet. That's probably not part of the conversation. But bottom line, these tools, understanding those models, where it's coming from, what the genesis of it, how it's been impacted, is incredibly important for anybody to understand, but very important for law firms to understand because a lot of the guarantees and assurances that you need to make about the data that is, or what information is coming in, or how you're actually using it.
I tend to view this as law firms, this is another vendor that you're engaging at some level. If you're a sole practitioner or Am Law 100 firm, and at some level, you've got to have a degree of comfort with the vendor that you're using. And so, I mean, you've mentioned OpenAI, which is the company behind ChatGPT. You know, they seem to have, I don't want to call it market share, but maybe that's the right terminology. Just because everyone is more familiar with them than many others that are coming out there. But where would it even start? This may be a difficult question to answer, but where would a firm even start if it was looking to use, let's say, a ChatGPT type functionality just generally in their law firm?
Yeah, I mean, this is really where the challenge sits. And it's one of the things that we've talked about and debated a lot. I mean, I think this goes back, and a lot of this, you know, will ultimately set with the larger firms, I think, with the general counsel. I mean, it goes back, I mean, while it's different, there's a lot of the similar discussions that we had around the whole cyber issue and the way the firm is going to engage, the way it's going to do. I mean, I think it will be very wrong for firms not to have an overarching philosophy or idea about how they want to use it. And the thing about it is, these are not going to be solutions that's going to come from, I mean, it's not going to be IT that's going to be showing up saying, hey, we ought to use AI. You know,
No.
Business development, it is going to be practice groups that are looking at some of the research tools. And again, that's where I think a lot of the different tools come into play. But then we'll need to be an assessment and an understanding of what are we willing to take. I mean, a lot that I've been reading lately is that the AI stuff, I mean, it is changing incredibly quickly. Again, you can read almost every day about what is going on. I do think there's some value in it, and firms need to start developing kind of an idea about where we're going to engage and where we're going to use it. I mean, a long time ago, looking at document automation and all, I mean, I did a lot of that work, you know, at the practice group level. You know, we were looking at very specialized research tools at the practice group level. And I think AI will begin to influence a lot of those tools that are already out there and a lot of the automation tools that are out there. And it may be at the practice groups driving that. You will have some of the other groups coming forward just saying, hey, well, wait a minute, I can use AI on the BD side. And there will be a responsibility, I think, to understand the tools, how they're going to be employed. These things are going to take a lot of resources. Trust me, they're not. You buy the tool and you install it and it's ready to go and work. There will be, you know, an incredible amount of understanding and training. And so I think it will be very easy for groups to become overwhelmed at the number of tools. And again, I mean, I read the legal tech news and stuff every day. Everyone has an AI tool that they're coming out with. It's part of their solution. And it will be, and to kind of back up to the question, that's where I think firms really have to start. I mean, they should be talking about this stuff already and really building the framework, how they're going to understand and evaluate and ultimately integrate. And they have to have resources. I mean, I thought it was very nice that, you know, at the discussion in Austin, you had a lot of chief operating officers with their human resource counterpoints, which are really over a lot of the training and all, because these tools will be great. But unless you really get the user interfaces and what is being termed now these universal interfaces built correctly, if people train to use them, these tools are going to be very, very frustrating. And I do think I'll go a step further and just say the way this has been characterized a lot around legal is these will be, I mean, and this gets back to your point about being replaced. This is not about, I think, replacing lawyers at all. This is about providing assistance and efficiency in your ability to go and get information. And I think it will be, whether it's on the research side, whether it's on consuming internal metrics, whether it's, you know, finding out things about clients. These tools will help you do things a lot faster if they're engineered and implemented the right way. But that is going to be part of the philosophy and part of what the firm has to understand. I do think on the small firm side, this gives some of the small firms the ability to engage and do things that they haven't been able to do before, because they will be able to acquire some of these efficiency providing technologies that they might and buy it piecemeal, buy it out of the cloud and do things rather than worry about larger solutions. So I don't think this is just a big firm issue. I think small firms need to be thinking about it too, but they just need to approach it a little bit differently and have a different set of people that they're involved with.
Have you seen much on the client side, either pressure from clients to kind of utilize these tools to be efficient or pushback from clients that are nervous about it?
I have read a little bit of both. And this is one of the things that one of the reasons that I think that the general counsels need to be involved. Really, anybody needs to be involved that is having to read outside counsel guidelines that are coming in. This gets back to the cyber issue. Clients will say, hey, listen, not allowed to use AI at all. Well, what does it mean? What kind of AI? I mean, there needs to be more detail in that about, like, we can't use generative AI to produce, you know, any work for them. It's very different than saying, hey, we're going to be using AI to do research, or we're going to be using AI on the metric side, understand more about profitability and matters or something like that. And so I think they need to stay away from that. You'll have other firms that will be saying, or other companies that will be coming to firms, you know, saying that you need to be using AI to gain efficiencies. Well, that's a real general statement. What does that mean? I mean, I think this is where kind of the document automation piece will come into play, and the firms will need to be able to articulate how they will use it to gain these efficiencies. Most companies already say, listen, we're not going to pay for legal research and all that other stuff. So I think that is an advantage from an operational standpoint from the law firm side. There's a lot of things that they can automate and gain efficiencies that will help them. And this has been the eternal argument. It goes back to my days as CIO, when I would go out and look for a piece of technology to bring in. And it was very hard to go to maybe one of our department heads or whatever else and say, listen, I've got a piece of a technology that will allow you to build fewer hours. That argument was a tough one to have. I mean, my debate with a lot of those partners at the time was, if we're not prepared to do it, other firms will be. So we at least need to be prepared to engage it. But I do think that firms will be able to do some things quicker. You know, talking about some of the tools that streamline some of the prompt automation. If you're a net document shop, some of what they do will have prompt automation elements in their tool that will allow you to document assembly faster. I mean, it builds the prompts. You answer a series of questions and it builds the prompts for you, so you don't have to. Those kind of tools, I think, will be very good and will ultimately you know, where you're, you know, seeing flat fee or fixed fee work, you know, you're having to gain some efficiency there. It will allow you to do it. But as I'm talking about this, I mean, it raises a lot of the issues about how you're tracking and you're looking and monitoring this stuff already. But bottom line, that's where the ask and where, you know, the clients will become better aware of this stuff and where it fits. And we'll start asking firms, what are you doing with it? And why aren't you engaged with it? And particularly on the efficiency side of the equation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could get into a whole debate about what this is going to do to the billable hour model. And then maybe that's part of this conversation. But most of what you just said in response to Jody's question, Tim, it was directly relevant to that. Because as you point out, these models are supposed to make you more efficient. Well, if you're more efficient, then you can bill fewer hours. If you bill fewer hours, then your bills ought to be lower and the client spends ought to be lower for the same amount of work. I would say it's fraught with difficulties for the legal industry generally as a whole, just because we're so heavily built on the billable hour model.
You know, I mean, I've been having the billable hour debate with folks going back to the 90s. I mean, everything, you know, would go after the billable hour. And it has changed a lot. I mean, I think technology has made people more and more efficient to be able to get more done. I think that that is ultimately where AI, whether it's generative AI or some other form, will ultimately help. I think for everybody to understand, it's not going to change tomorrow. It is one of those evolutionary things that will come into play. And I do think that it's important to understand the solutions where they fit, and then people will have to adapt to it. And again, I think over time, firms that are willing to adapt will be better positioned to compete than ignore it. I mean, it's kind of like any technology, whether it be, I mean, I remember like when I first brought BlackBerries into the firm, you know, back in the late 90s.
There's a flashback. Oof.
I think Dennis Fahmeter spoke about this on his podcast. It was kind of the easiest project we had ever done. Dennis was as a very good friend. He was the director over the real technical side of the IT organization and eventually moved into CIO role as I vacated that role, moved on to other things. But he and I were doing a lot of tests to try to make email mobile. And so we were looking at, you know, some of the SkyToll pagers and everything else. And then BlackBerry happened to pop up at an event in Dallas, you know, where we were like, hey, this would be a great tool for us to have. I bought 40 devices directly from BlackBerry at the time. And we put 20 in Houston. We put 20 in a newly opened New York office we had. And within 6 months, we had 1,000 devices deployed. It was the easiest project we'd ever done. The downside to it is, that was one of those things that just made us connected. And I bring that up because it was an inflection point. It was a shift in kind of a responsiveness attitude that people had. No more could you say, well, I didn't see that email. You saw the email. People knew you saw it. And we almost had to respond to it. I remember when we brought them into the firm, immediately I had gone on a vacation with my family, with my wife, and I had two young sons at the time. And we were sitting by the swimming pool, and I had a BlackBerry, and my wife was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, just giddy as I could be, I'm doing email. Little did I know that that would be the anchor that would weigh me down over the years.
Oh, that's so true.
AI is one of those things that I think will be those kind of technologies. And in 3 years, we'll be having a completely different conversation about it. It will just be an integrated part of what we do. And you will accept it and use it whether you like it or not. I mean, if you recently, I mean, on any of your home stuff, you know, did any of the Office 365 updates, there are new AI elements in there to where it's starting to try to finish sentences at your top. And, you know, if you're in email or you're in a Word document, it's saying, hey, I think I read this email and you have a task. Do you want to move it to your task list? You know, those things are coming already. And it's one of the things that I warn firms about. I mean, that is coming out just more in the updates that are coming with your general updates. So these things are going to become a little bit of a nuisance and that people are going to see them and be going, what is this? And how do I need to respond to this? And some of it you will need to dial back in the firms because people don't want to know. It will be confusing. It has the potential to create some issues for firms as far as information management also.
Minimize time spent sifting through search results and discover a more precise way to research with Westlaw Precision. The latest version of Westlaw brings new capabilities, including generative AI, more precise researching, and expanded KeyCite functionality. Plus, you'll get access to tools like QuickCheck and litigation analytics. Give your practice every advantage with access to industry-leading legal research technology that can help you find what you need faster than ever before with Westlaw Precision.
So we talked about ChatGPT generally as it's sort of what people think of in terms of AI and the use case for it, just typing in questions and so forth. But I think you've mentioned some of what we think of as traditional legal vendors like Thomson Reuters and Lexis and so forth are rolling out AI features in their products. And so it does seem it's a natural fit to me that to allow those folks who have a lot invested and are spending a lot of money on their AI development to sort of test the water in terms of how that capability could benefit the provision of legal services. I know, you know, for example, that Thomson Reuters not too long ago acquired Casetext. And I know that they're getting ready to roll out their Casetext type functionality, which includes some real, you know, what we would think of as AI type features, summarizing, outlining, and that sort of thing within that platform. So it seems to me, Tim, that's a pretty low risk. It's sort of that's the low bar to entry for law firms would be to sign on to something like that and see the real benefit of it. And maybe it would spread from there.
Yeah, I think that is right. You know, looking at these tools, I mean, and what these organizations are trying to do. I mean, I will tell you, there are a lot of things that are being rolled out, you know, and they will talk about them being in test forms or somewhat experimental or whatever else. It's just important, I think, to understand the state. And with these tools, again, and, you know, Thomson Reuters is one. I talked about the Net Documents pieces. I think there are some very valuable tools out there for today. I think firms, again, it will be having conversations internally about where do we want to go with this and where do we want to focus our investment? I mean, what I was talking to the chief operating officers, you know, back in September, you guys are all in the middle of doing your plan development right now. You probably need to earmark some dollars for some of these tools because these tools are not going to come without, you know, some added expense. And then I do think that they are going to fall into the project mix and that you're going to have your project managers dedicated to dealing with it, training resources, you know, to get people using it. I do think that there are low risk elements that firms can bring in and start leveraging. And they should do that. That will be part of the education and part of your cutting your, you know, teeth, so to speak, on this and doing some very targeted, you know, applications with this and then broadening from there. There are some nice, easy, I think, safe uses out there. I think the research side will offer a lot. Is people just have to understand the downsides, that they're not perfect. Some of these vendors are doing the fine-tuning necessary, I think, to limit the hallucinations that you'll hear about in some of the large language models and all, and narrow it. I do think that, and this kind of gets back to what is coming with the regulatory piece and, you know, where a lot of the bar associations are commenting on. You guys as lawyers still have the responsibility to ultimately look at it and make a determination of whether what you're seeing is viable or not. And I think that is really going to be the important piece. A lot of this stuff, I think initially early on, is going to be in the assistant phase. It's going to assist and help you. It's not going to replace anything that you do. It just will hopefully help you gather information and get things sorted, you know, for a client faster, but you still will have the responsibility to be comfortable with what you're ultimately producing.
It's kind of like hiring a legal assistant. You know, you need to make sure that you're hiring a competent legal assistant with a good background. And this is very much the same, just on a technical side instead of an HR side.
That is a great, great analogy. And some of these tools even come up and have, like, they are a legal assistant type technology. If you look at it, like, you know, what some firms are doing, they're looking at this AI, you know, document assistant, but it really is focused, you know, on like what that paralegal or what that project assistant or something would do. And again, I think that is where maybe some of it will be displaced at times, but it's still up to you to make sure that it's accurate and it's what you want to see.
It really seems like it touches on every aspect of the legal industry. I mean, starting back, I think you mentioned BD or business development. I could see use cases for it all throughout the marketing functions and BD functions of a law firm. We've talked a lot about how it would affect the delivery of legal services being a major factor, but there's other functions too. There's administration, operations, security and privacy. It's sort of this weird double-edged sword because on the one hand, you're very concerned about privacy and security, but on the other, there are probably AI tools that will make it better, make it easier for you to monitor your security on your computer systems and so forth.
Well, I mean, I'm going to make one comment about the security side, and then I will talk about the business development side. One of the early, and I say early, you know, this is 2016 or 2017 things that I was thinking about from an AI perspective, you know, happened to be on the cyber side. I mean, we were employing all these tools, we were doing all this monitoring, you know, and creating all these logs, which no human would have the time or ability to go back and review all this stuff. Well, you can use AI to do that. And that's really what a lot of the tools out there, you know, that's where the Palo Altos and whatnot are really using those tools now to interpret that data and push it to real time. Sometimes they will argue real time because it's looking for patterns in that data. It's looking for adverse patterns, things that you should highlight. And so I think there is good use for that. And I think firms have probably already been using AI to some degree without it really being broadcast or people using it. I do think on the BD side, it's one of those things, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I think where you're just producing content or whatever, I mean, maybe you're doing pitches or things like that. I mean, I've encouraged people to use it like they're, you know, writing their objective in their resume. There's fairly easy ways to engineer a prompt to produce, you know, a very coherent, very intelligent sounding objective for a resume. I think BD people can use that. The one thing that I think folks will have to be careful about is if they're using any of the mainstream tools out there, anything that you post to and what it generates is recaptured. And so that's where a lot of firms are saying that, you know, we want to be careful about using it or they're restricting use or whatever else because they don't want their information that may be in one of the prompts to end up there in one of the public databases. And so that is one concern. But I think from a BD standpoint, there are great uses there. And I think anybody that's producing content where it's not beetle opinion or anything like that. I mean, it is just producing something that somebody's going to read. I mean, it's a great tool to help automate that and enhance content and make the sound really good.
Mm-hmm. We see some of the benefits. You described those really well. I mean, efficiency, capitalizing, hopefully, on firms' knowledge bases. It's easy to see the upside to AI generally in the use of it. And we've talked a little bit about some of the downsides, some of the risks. We've talked some about confidentiality, essentially that the model is only good as what you put in, you know, garbage in, garbage out, and that sort of thing. You mentioned the concept of hallucinations, which we really haven't explained. I do want to talk about that in the context of the Mata versus Avianca case that a lot of folks who have listened to our podcast and follow the legal news will have heard about. I know you know about it. So talk to us a little bit about Mata and hallucinations generally and explain the kind of risks of over-reliance on ChatGPT or other models.
It is a real risk, and I will move sideways a little bit and talk to another lawyer. This is a litigator that I was having a conversation with, and he just thought it'd be interesting to go out. You know, he had a case he was working on, and he would pose a question to OpenAI, and it started citing all these cases and all this stuff. He immediately looked at it and thought, oh my God, I missed all this relevant stuff. Well, what he figured out when he started looking into it is it was just making up stuff. I mean, it was making cases and references up. None of this stuff really existed. That is the issue with hallucination. Again, these large language models, I mean, I hate to say it this way, there are probably people that would argue with me about it. I mean, it is essentially being trained on a lot of stuff and rendered into, you know, math. And so there's been questions about, you know, these systems learn foreign languages. I mean, God, they're so smart. They learn foreign languages. Well, they're just looking at stuff that is fed to them in foreign language, and they're just seeing the patterns. And at times, they will tend to regurgitate stuff or try to fill a void, so to speak, and will throw out information that they may be correct or may not be. You know, there's the other thing, too, about some of the LLMs being poisoned, which people can go in and specifically engineer an LLM and engineer certain facts into it. That's where the concern, you know, around misinformation and whatever is going on. And so you've got an LLM that may be producing really, you know, correct information. And so then all of a sudden it throws out a piece of information that you assume is correct because everything else was. And it was a very engineered point that is wrong. And that is the downside to it. I will say too, you know, there are a lot of firms that, okay, listen, I want to use my materials. I want to build my own LLM. Well, it gets back to the knowledge, you know, information that we were talking about, you know, from 20 years ago. What are you going to focus it at? You need a good slate of information that you're comfortable training on. You don't want to train on everything because just like we know, and I know you guys, I mean, even on the appellate side, and I've spent enough time in legal, I mean, there are many versions of a document until it's fully negotiated. And a lot of times the fully negotiated document or the final document is not what you want in your model either. There's some other subset of that. And so figuring out what you're going to put into that model ultimately, which is what will drive the results. I worked with lawyers for a long time and I've greatly valued my time in legal. They are a skeptical group of people, which, you know, the skeptical group.
That is true.
My view is on all this stuff, you know, when it starts spinning things back, lawyers are typically going to look at it and want to scrutinize it. And they clearly should for, you know, a long time. As these things will be move more like human-like behavior, you know, there's not human, it's not true intelligence yet. And so it is the assistant. I think it will help us in a lot of ways, but there are a lot of downsides to it, you know, that still have to be, I mean, it's just not perfect. I mean, there's not a panacea with any of these. And so I would not use it and assume, I mean, there's no way that you can assume 100% of it is accurate, no matter what you're asking. They will have tendencies to make stuff up and just regurgitate stuff. And if they were trained with bad data, they will give bad or erroneous, less than complete answers.
I was just thinking about what are the takeaways from that Mata case, and you've covered a lot of that already. I don't want to recite the facts of the case. I mean, just look it up if anybody's not familiar with it who's hearing this. Essentially, some New York lawyers decided to rely on ChatGPT to draft a motion or a response, and it did hallucinate and created false citations. And the lawyers wound up getting sanctioned as a result of that. That emphasizes, I think, the real takeaway from that is, one, don't get in over your head from the start by relying on something you don't understand, because in part, I know one of the responses that those guys gave was, well, I thought this was just a research service that I could just plug in and rely on what it gave me, which that ultimately the court didn't find that persuasive. But two, you know, you've got to have human eyes on it and human eyes with the experience to know what looks like it could be a hallucination versus what's not. Because you can't tell, as you pointed out, Tim, sometimes that stuff looks really good. So that to me is what helps to answer the question of whether this is going to result in taking away all our jobs. Until that software, until that those programs get to that point where they're hallucination free, you don't have to worry about poisoning anymore. The answer would seem like it'd be no, and it's probably not going to happen over the course of my career. So with all that said, though, how would you advise lawyers who are looking to dip their toe in the water or create sort of a general approach to adopting AI? I know we're talking about a wide variety of practices and practice areas, and we've talked about solos, large firms. I mean, what's the starting point?
I do think it really is kind of engaging this assistant mentality, and it may be doing things that are kind of away from the actual legal work initially. I mean, some of the things that, you know, I was talking about might be a little bit intrusive from the Office 365 standpoint and what's going on with some of the copilot elements there. Is it saying, you know, listen, I think I see a task in your email. It is, think there's something you need to deal here. It is completing sentences. I mean, I think it will help set up there. There will be a number of tools, I think, on the research side, on the filing side, that will enhance some of the document management systems and all where we're using about where to file stuff or what to organize. I mean, I think those are some really good applications. I do think on the research side, it has incredible potential to help at least fast track. I mean, I remember going in the days when we first started introducing the electronic research pieces, you know, and there was concern about where we would miss them. I mean, there was the lawyers that just really wanted to have a book in their hands and really wanted to fill that paper and sit down in the library and do that work. And it took a while to transition to where the libraries are non-existent. We don't allocate any space to them anymore. Everything is electronic. And I think that the AI elements of that research will be incredibly helpful. Once people are comfortable with it, they will continue to check it. You know, I will use it, but then I'll probably look a little bit further to make sure that we're not missing anything else. It'll be the same thing on the e-discovery piece. I mean, you're giving up some level of control, and it will take some time for you to be comfortable with that. But I do, those are the solutions that lawyers will look to. I mean, it will be through some of the document automation pieces where we've already introduced some document assembly tools and things like that. AI, I think, will play into that as we're making suggestions. And when we're building that office stuff, it is coming from the law firm, you know, work product where we're capturing kind of standard clause. You know, you've got clause banks. I mean, going a little bit to the transactional side of the house and talking about that, but in building those clause banks and whatnots, you know, AI will help streamline some of that. And over time, people will get more comfortable, more confident in what it's helping to do. And I do think it will help streamline those functions and really surface that information. What is relevant information in a very direct, very focused place will be the initial tool sets. And then as this evolves and these systems are trained better and we have more control over the training and all that, people will get more comfortable. But again, it's a few years down the road. I don't see it as a replacement. I just see it as further assistant and you're getting your work done. Now, I do think that people, the question is, well, does it take away some, you know, what legal assistants are doing or what very junior associates are doing? I think that is a question that's still yet to be answered. I mean, you have to look at the associates you're getting them in and you're training them to ultimately become more senior folks, partners in the firm or whatever else. And so there's still be a path for them, but a lot of these tools could impact ultimately what they're doing, but it's not there today.
Are you advising the law firms that you work with on the development of policies regarding the use of AI?
Yeah, we are talking about that some, and it kind of gets into the regulatory piece, which I'll touch on just briefly, which is it is an evolutionary tool. And you're seeing these big blanket high level statements made. Biden's come out now and the Commerce Department is going to have, you know, an AI function. They just, what I would argue is they really don't know what they're going to do yet. You've got a lot of people who are trying to regulate something that they don't understand at all.
True.
You've got these international groups that are coming together to make the statements, well, we've got to do this stuff to protect the good of people overall. Well, I'm not sure exactly what that means yet. And so let's get into the details of it. But I do think that is one of the things that the firm is going to have to stay in touch with, to what's going on with the regulatory side of it, and then have this philosophy internally about how we're going to use it. It's one thing to just block OpenAI and say people can't go to the site and do it. I think with the offerings that are coming out in tools, you know, firms need to be thinking about, listen, we subscribe to Lexis already. Now they're going to have an AI offering. How are we going to consider it? How are we going to integrate it? These are the conversations firms need to be having. They need to be, you know, having conversations about what they're not going to do with it and developing strategies about how they're going to deal with the outside counsel guidelines that have AI elements into them. You know, where some of it may be, I mean, some of it's simply going to be pushing back and saying, you need to further clarify what you're talking about. Just like what we did on the cyber side, where they made some very blanket statements that were very difficult to interpret or apply internally. What are we going to do? Firms need to be having those conversations and need to be thinking about it and need to have active dialogue about it. And we're trying to do as much education as we can. I mean, there's some involvement when they do decide to bring a tool in. Well, you know, what do you need to do? There is thinking about, you know, how it's coming in and how you're going to integrate it, how you're going to manage the project, how you're going to train it, you know, how are you going to configure these tools? You've got a lot of different options. What are you going to do? Every single tool. I think that the overarching philosophy and policies and all about it are a little bit to slow down. And I think that is a good thing. The acquisition and adoption of a lot of these tools, and if they understand exactly what they're going to do. The last thing you want to happen inside a firm is for like a BD group to say, hey, listen, we're bringing in an AI tool. And for no one to understand what they're doing or what they're bringing in, there is going to have to be the dissection, I think, starting with the leadership of the firm. You know, I go to the general counsel, somebody that fills that role that is protecting the firm across these areas. There will need to be IT involvement. You have to dissect all that technology, understand where it's sitting. I mean, is the technology recline cloud technology or not? Is it something that's going to be on-prem? How's it going to integrate and talk to? I mean, there's just a great number of questions that are going to come up. And I think firms are going to need to be prepared to deal with this stuff. And the more work they do on the front end of it, the easier it will be to address the solutions when they start coming. And trust me, the request, I mean, I can see it already. Practice groups that read about a new tool, that's exactly what I need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right now, I used to always argue all the time. I mean, I hated like when, you know, I'd have, you know, one of our attorneys on an airplane looking at the SkyMall catalog and would see some great piece of technology and then we get the phone call, we really need this. And it's nothing that we need at all. Or we've already got three solutions that play around that. You just have never bothered to use any of them.
Oh, yeah.
it gets down to training and education. And that is going to be a huge piece of that. You know, once the firms decide what they're going to do, it is going to be understanding that interface and how it's trained and how it's developed. I think there's an argument today for firms to go and start engaging in some of the prompt engineering and things like that so people understand how to engage and use some of these ChatGPT elements. Even if they're not doing the prompts themselves, they will still then understand what some of the prompt automation tools are doing, and they'll be able to dissect it and work with us on the implementation side better, and really assimilation of a lot of these technologies. And again, it is not going away. It's only going to escalate. We're going to see, you know, more of it come. And it's just one of those things that, you know, is a little bit overwhelming. And I feel a little bit in this call. There's so many directions and to talk about things and so many things to consider. It is a very challenging, straightforward, easy, simple concept, you know, to bring forward.
It is. But, and then you're saying this, and in the back of my head, I'm hearing, all the potential ethical issues, both in terms of technological competence and then thinking about the different ethical areas that AI use impacts across all the various practice groups. And it kind of makes your head spin.
There are an incredible number. I mean, the privacy and ethical issues are huge. And it is back to that philosophical discussion. I mean, it's the reason firms need to be having the conversations before they ever really start bringing these tools in. I mean, there will be the conversations, you know, around the cost, all those stuff. I get that. But where the ethical and the privacy pieces come into play is understanding the tools and what they're doing, where your information is being stored, when you're interfacing, what is it doing with that? I mean, again, a lot of firms have come out and said, hey, we're starting to, you know, we built our own ChatGPT. Well, trust me, it is sitting in the Azure and it's locked down because it's in that Azure construct. Even though it's using some of the OpenAI pieces, it's not escaping that container, so to speak. But those are some of the technical considerations that firms will have to have when they're talking about any of these solutions. Where does it sit and what does it really do? And it's just a huge challenge. And I wish it was easier. You know, I mean, I told the group when I met with them, I wish I could just tell you, this is a solution. This is what you do. It is not that easy. It's just not that easy.
Yeah.
And that's what lawyers want. Okay, what's the answer, Tim?
Right.
That was really my first slide in that presentation. If you're looking for me to tell you today that this is the definitive answer in AI, you're not going to get it from me. You know, not today. Not yet. Maybe in 2 or 3 years from now, I can at least narrow it down more, but that is very hard to do. It's everywhere and everybody is trying it to some degree.
Well, and that's actually the perfect lawyerly answer is, well, it depends.
Yeah. Tim's clearly learned a few things for
his years of V&E
and a career of hanging around lawyers. Yeah, for sure. Well, so what are the resources that you would recommend to lawyers, whatever their practice setting, who are just interested in learning more? I mean, you can get online and read all kinds of stuff that's either gloom and doom or does portray it as a panacea. And it seems like there's not a lot necessarily in between. But what are there some practical guides that you could refer our listeners to that might consult?
I think on the legal side, I mean, I tend to, you know, read a lot that comes out in some of the AM Law tech publications because they tend to be very focused on what lawyers are looking for in the solutions and the efficiency and the responsibilities and the laws that I talk about will be reiterated and reinforced there. Also talk about the tools that are being released. And I look at those and again, I immediately gravitate towards what is the technology and how does it really work? But beyond that, I mean, there are problem is, again, there's too much out there to try to consume. And lawyers are incredibly busy people. You've got a lot to keep up with. It is hard. I started using some technology resources like TLDR, which is just an acronym for too long, didn't read. And there's an AI variant of that, which will have a lot of snippets, which I will go to and read. And I'll be perfectly honest, I build some Google alerts at times on very specific and narrow regulatory AI pieces and stuff where I want to see things that are being serviced or talk about that I may miss. I use tools like Wired Magazine. You know, I mean, again, there's not a lot of good central resources. I get information from a couple of different places. I do think from a legal standpoint, firms can look at what's coming out in really any of the legal trade publications, whether it be American Lawyer, any of the subsets of that, or any of the Law 360 stuff, you know, anything that touches on AI. And again, I think the good elements of those, I just reading an article that came out this week that's really focused on some of the use cases and efficiencies, which I think is what will be most relevant. If there are people that really want to get on the technical side out there, you can go out there and you can, I mean, there's, you know, tons of Reddit stuff you can follow and you can get into the GitHub stuff on, you know, what is being built on the LLMs and everything else. But it's mind-numbingly tedious at times and it's way beyond what most people will be interested in doing. And I guess the last point I make on that, I think anything that talks about the efficiency, you know, use cases of it is important as well as the regulatory pieces. Those are what I would focus on the most. And I think, you know, particularly in the regulatory piece is evolving very, very quickly. And particularly this, since it has an international focus now, in fact, just in the last week or so, there was a meeting in London with a number of countries represented and everybody is there saying, you know, we need universal control over this. There is a concern that AI is going to be this runaway stuff. There's been groups that have got together that want to hold this 6-month kind of ceasefire moratorium on development on these new frontier models, which is just not good. I mean, I don't see this happening. I don't think any of these countries can really get control of it yet, but it's going to be interesting to see what they come out and how they try to regulate it and control it. And it can ultimately do more harm than good, but we will see. It's not there yet. They're just not doing it yet.
Tim, we really appreciate you being on. This is just fascinating stuff and kind of makes my head spin and gives me a little bit of anxiety thinking about all that's out there. But as we kind of close out, our tradition here is to let our guests leave us with a tip or a war story. And you've given us plenty of tips. If you have another one, we'd love to hear it. Or if you have a war story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear that too.
Yeah, the war story piece, I've probably already covered talking about the Blackberries a little bit before.
That was a good story. And
a couple of pieces of technology that have left us bruised and battered over the year. That's one. Yeah, I've got a few around cybersecurity too, where I will tell one. I think this has potential to be AI, where we get a bunch of lawyers on board. They tell us what they want to do. I will go back on the security side. We're talking about moving to like a containerized model on our mobile devices. And we had a technology group, a GC group that very focused on that. As soon as we did it, and then they really started understanding what containerized technology meant, that people's core play didn't work the way that they used to want, you know, used to like it to work. It didn't integrate as much because we were blocking off the sharing of our technology pieces with what was generally in iOS at the time. And we had to undo some of that and open it up and let, you know, a few folks use some of the older technology so their Apple CarPlay would work. It's amazing methods at times, but that's one of those things we just have to adapt. And I think that is ultimately going to be what happens with AI. There will be pieces of it that are really good, but there's going to be something out there that people aren't going to like. And, you know, we'll get hammered with it. I think in parting, we covered a lot. And I will say that, I mean, I started really getting focused on AI a lot this year, about March or April. I mean, I paid attention to it, you know, in years before, but for different reason. And with ChatGPT, it was so much coming out. I just sort of started getting it. I mean, I wanted to understand it at a fundamental type level. And the reason I started really breaking apart a lot of the neural nets and things like that, because I used to do some coding in my background. I wanted to understand how the coding was built. And then what I started reading and what I read as of late is that people that code it don't really understand the way that a lot of these neural nets react the way that they do, which made me feel better about what they're doing and the way they're trying to build it. I think it's just one of those things that is going to continue to evolve very quickly. It's something that you can't ignore and you have to pay attention to. It will have an impact. I mean, it is an immersive technology, whether it is on the legal side. I mean, you will see it a lot just in your personal lives, on your iOS devices, on your Android devices, the way you interact with your car, the way everything that you do works, it will impact. And so understand it in your personal life, and then we're going to have to understand how it impacts and how it applies in our professional life. It will continue to evolve. I think lawyers, what they need to understand about it is they can't ignore it. They're going to have to pay attention to it and embrace it and understand it. It is one of those things that you can't just say, well, AI is not going to impact me in my practice, and so I'm not going to pay any attention. That is the wrong attitude to have. They need to pay attention to it. They need to be asking questions. If there are things that are happening that you don't understand, ask somebody. Pick up the phone. Talk to somebody on the admin side, whether it be on the tech side or wherever else. Talk to other lawyers and be curious about it and engage with it. It is going to evolve. I agree. It will evolve way beyond my professional career, but there's a piece of it I have to be engaged with and deal with during that. And at some point, I'll leave it for some younger folks to deal with, but it has potential to be really good and really powerful tools. So I think it's just one of those things that is here to stay. It will impact your life every day, and you better find ways to accept it, whether you like it or not.
Well, thank you, Tim. This has been great. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a great parting thought. And so appreciate the time, and we'll look forward to learning more as we go.
I appreciate it. Very good to talk to you both, and look forward to being involved and maybe talking more soon in the future.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.